So in 1 Corinthians 2, verses 1 to 10, this is actually beginning, well, almost the beginning of a series of Corinthians. You're probably aware we're following Corinthians through into July, 1 Corinthians. And then after that, we're tackling Jeremiah, which I think will be a whole different kettle of fish. 50-odd chapters, but I imagine we're going to be looking at highlights rather than the whole book. Before we look at today's words, I just want to tell you another thing about my dad. I told you a story about my dad last week. One of my dad's favourite aphorisms, which he often used to quote to my brother and I as we were progressing through O-levels and A-levels, was this. He said, "When brains walked in, common sense walked out." Now, my dad wasn't anti-intellectual. Indeed, both our parents very much encouraged the two of us into higher education. But I think his point was that wisdom wasn't necessarily derived through knowledge. Knowledge isn't necessarily the path to wisdom. Of course, as he probably realised, he was merely echoing the words of the 6th century BC Chinese philosopher Lao Tzu, who wrote, "A wise man has no extensive knowledge. He who has extensive knowledge is not a wise man." I'm sure you're more than familiar with the words of Lao Tzu. But my brother and I went off regardless to feed our brains anyway, and maybe common sense did depart, but others will be better judges of that, and indeed whether either of us ever became wise. But Paul has a lot to say about wisdom, particularly about preachers and wisdom. He says a lot in the first two chapters of the first letter to the Corinthians about that, and how it contrasts with what the world might expect. Now, Paul, of course, himself was no fool. He was a highly educated Greek-speaking Jew. And we know from Acts chapter 17 that he could hold his own even in Athens in the debating hall. You know, the Areopagus. We read how he very much held his own with the philosophers and the thinkers of the time in Athens. But Paul has a razor-sharp focus in his preaching that should be a singular lesson, not just for preachers, people like me of our day, but also for those of us who listen to preachers, both for you and for me. And I want to concentrate on three themes of Paul's teaching. You've got them printed at the bottom of your little reading there. They are wisdom, revelation, and power. So first heading, wisdom. 1 Corinthians 2, verse 1. He says, "When I came to you, brothers, I did not come with eloquence or superior wisdom, as I proclaimed to you the testimony about God." When I came to you, brothers. He's referring to his first church planting visit to Corinth in about AD 50. Corinth at that time was probably the largest commercial hub in Greece. Its culture was typically Greek. It wasn't a university city, but nonetheless, there was a great interest in thought and philosophy and intellect and wisdom and so forth. But it was also a city steeped in immorality, having at its centre the temple to Aphrodite, the goddess of love. Or maybe, actually, better known, the goddess of lust, from the way things were going in that city. And so the fledgling church at Corinth soon found itself distracted not just by the thoughts and the intellectualism and all the pursuit of wisdom of that place, but also the loose morals that surrounded it. So in 5 years' time, by AD 55, when Paul writes this little letter to Corinth from Ephesus, where he's staying at that point, by that time a number of issues have arisen within the church that needs to correct, and we're going to follow those over these next few weeks. But the first for today is about doctrine and the teaching in the church. I wonder how many dull sermons you've had to sit under. I'm going to apologise now for my contribution to that number. But how many preachers these days deliver dry, intellectual, impotent sermons? And sadly, if you look at the preacher lists at many of our great church institutions, cathedrals and so forth, you'll discover often they seem to have been chosen primarily for their erudition. And their sermons are more lectures than they are heartfelt preaching. And the emphasis, sadly, can be entirely on oratory and rhetoric and smart words rather than on the Spirit's leading in preaching. And of course, that's a tightrope that all preachers must walk to prepare something that's worth listening to, that holds water in terms of argument and structure, but that hearers can follow without needing a degree, certainly a degree in theology, and something also that says something to our hearts, something that moves our hearts and sets us off on a path of change. Preaching must be transformational. It must challenge, it must change our lives, not just stimulate our thoughts. It must have a kind of a ministry message week by week. Richard Rendell, departed now of these parts, once told me that his preferred sermon audience would be a congregation of university students and academics. He loved the challenge of crafting a sermon that could really make people think. And of course, you'll know, he was very good at that. My preferred audience, if I'm honest, would be a bunch of criminals and wasters. I love the challenge of keeping their attention, keeping the attention of people who are more than happy to yawn in your face and tell you afterwards how boring your sermon was. Not, of course, that this congregation would ever dream of doing that. But there is another aphorism which says this. It says, there should be no devotion without theology, and there should be no theology without devotion. In other words, preachers must employ their intellect as they craft their preaching, but also their preaching must be devotional. It must stimulate a deeper devotion to the things of God. It must be about changing lives. It must be about transformation. It must be about training in righteousness and godliness. So what then is the secret to good preaching? Well, surprise, surprise, it's not about good oratory, but rather it's about the preacher listening to what God has to say for that audience and delivering it as faithfully as possible. Paul summarizes that in verse 7 of our passage, 7 and 8. He says, we speak of God's secret wisdom, a wisdom that has been hidden and that God destined for our glory before time began. None of the rulers of this age understood it, for if they had, they would not have crucified the Lord of glory. The rulers of this age just don't get it. That's, you know, of Paul's age. Not just the chief priests and the authorities who crucified Jesus, but the spirit of philosophy and wisdom that pervaded that city and that culture. But of course, those attitudes to Jesus still pervade the culture of our day. How often do we hear of faith being dismissed as a crutch for the weak, or as worthless superstition by those who see themselves as more intelligent or wiser than we? But nothing's changed. When Paul spoke before that Areopagus in Acts 17 in Athens, we read, if you look at the passage, that some of them sneered at his words. Well, nothing seems to have changed much in 2,000 years. So what is this message of wisdom that Paul speaks? What is this transformational message that has not been understood by the rulers of the day? Well, that's my second heading, and it's revelation. Verse 9 of our passage says this. It says, no eye has seen, no ear has heard, no mind has conceived what God has prepared for those who love him. But God has revealed it to us by his Spirit. This wisdom comes through revelation. It's not a wisdom that you and I can arrive at by intellectual processes. We can't deduce our way to God, to the spiritual wisdom that Paul preaches. Because the wisdom he preaches, as he wrote in the previous chapter, in chapter 1, if you read back, sounds like complete foolishness. And yet, Paul says, it is the power of God. And what is that message? What is the content of his wisdom? Well, he tells us in verse 2. He says simply this, I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. Jesus Christ and him crucified. He must be the center of all our preaching. He must be the focus of all our listening. My boss, when I was a curate down in Burford, told me that every sermon must be about Jesus Christ and him crucified, regardless of the text. Jesus must be the center. That's quite a task. But even the most obscure and difficult Old Testament passages must come back to Jesus Christ and him crucified, for that is the hinge point, the totality, the crux, to coin a phrase, of our faith. We rest on Jesus Christ and his crucifixion. He is our life belt, our safety net, our hope, and our salvation. So when I hear vicars preach sermons that are entirely about ecology or philosophy or about being nice and being better people or about rewilding the churchyard, I get just a little frustrated, and I think Paul would be frustrated also. Yes, of course those aspects of our life together as church are important, but our focus must always be on Jesus Christ and him crucified. If you were drowning in the ocean, let me give you an example. You're drowning in the ocean. You don't want the lifeboatman calling from his boat, do you realise how much microplastic there is in that sea that surrounds you? Equally, you don't want him calling out to you, do you realise how well the whale population is doing in these parts? Or can I tell you what we're doing back at the lifeboat station in terms of our soup kitchen for the homeless? None of those. We just want him to throw us the lifebelt. And yes, then when we're safely back on the boat, wrapped in our foil blanket with a hot mug of tea, then yes, you can tell us about all those other things as well. Jesus Christ and him crucified. That is who we need to hear about, certainly from the pulpit. We need to hear about the love that took him to a rough wooden cross to pay the price for your sin and my sin. We need to hear about his offer to bridge the chasm that our sin has caused between us and God. How that offer to bridge that chasm is unconditional and free. We need to hear about how his death and his resurrection takes the sting of the punishment that should have been ours. To mix metaphors, how he stood in our place in the dock while we walked free. How he took our sin and its penalty in his own body. How, in William Blake's words, Jesus is not a God far off, but a brother and a friend. Jesus Christ and him crucified. If you don't know Jesus, it sounds stupid. It sounds foolish. It sounds like the most ridiculous superstition, claptrap. But if you do know Jesus, these words are life and health and peace. So, wisdom, revelation, but there was one more heading, which is power. Back to our passage, verses 4 and 5. Paul says, my message and my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so your faith might not rest on men's wisdom, but on God's power. We've already observed that we don't find faith by deduction. We don't come to faith through wise and persuasive words. We don't think our way to God. No, we come through a demonstration of the Spirit's power. We're not talking about thunderbolts or the clouds cleaving open like a vision of glory, although occasionally that does happen. But we're talking about the power of the Spirit to cleave open our hearts, the power of the Spirit to break through our natural instincts to dismiss faith as nonsense. Jesus himself said this in John 16. He said, when the Spirit comes, he will convict the world of guilt in regard to sin and righteousness and judgment. So you and I need the power of the Holy Spirit to open our hearts to this godly wisdom. It's only by power, his power, to convict us of our sin that any of us ever comes to faith in the first place. And that in is itself a fabulous miracle, that he can turn us around from our old lives and set us on an entirely new direction. That is power, power at work in our hearts. But it's a power that doesn't stop there. Jesus continues in John 16. He says, when he, the Spirit of truth, comes, he will guide you into all truth. He will not speak on his own. He will speak only what he hears, and he will tell you what is yet to come. He will bring glory to me by taking from what is mine and making it known to you. So, three simple headings: wisdom, revelation, power. And the great news is that Jesus has the power to change our lives. You and I have only just begun on this great adventure that begins with Jesus Christ and him crucified. But just as in Corinth, there is plenty out there to distract us, plenty to seduce us, plenty to confuse us, different worldviews, different values, different perspectives, different attitudes, and even in our churches, different priorities. Paul engaged with the culture around him and he spoke truth into those situations, but he didn't rely on, as he puts it himself, clever words or persuasive arguments. He didn't build his ministry on his own ability and intellect and smartness. No, his focus was on just one thing: Jesus Christ and him crucified. And that must be the core of our gospel also, as a church collectively, but also as individuals, as we share our faith with those around us. Not to be distracted by so many popular issues, not to get hung up on all that's going on in our world, but to keep faithful to the saving power of the gospel. For if we do that, then it's down to the Holy Spirit to accomplish the rest, as he works his power both in our lives, but also in the lives of those around us that he touches as we live out our Christian life. Wisdom, revelation, and power.